Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. We're talking today with Dr. Stephen Livingston, who is in the Department of Political Science and also edits a quarterly publication called Global Commerce, Tennessee and the International Economy, in which he takes a look at imports and exports. And we also have a couple of other items we're going to be getting to later on, such as what he's going to be doing with an MTSU Instructional Technology Grant and his trip to Israel. But first, we welcome Dr. Stephen Livingston. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
In the latest edition of Global Commerce, you basically say it doesn't really make much sense to look at a state's imports and exports exclusive of the big picture. But we like to look at them anyway because it's fun to know what we're importing and exporting and what Tennessee leads in and what it doesn't lead in. Canada and Mexico are almost always continuing to be our top trade partners in Tennessee. How has the Tennessee import and export status changed during this recessionary period overall?
Well, the big change, of course, was a collapse in state exports, national exports, in 2009. It's really kind of remarkable, although it's come back. But if you're asking what's the biggest change, the big change was just a tremendous collapse in exports, a smaller collapse in imports. Imports wasn't quite for this state, quite as heavily affected as exports. But
did the bottom fall out for us to a greater extent than it did for other states,
or
how did we compare?
No, pretty much the same. Tennessee was suffering a little bit more than other states beforehand, so we did a little bit worse, but it's because of factors before the recession. Mm-hmm. Automobiles, in particular, was the big problem.
And we, in addition to automobiles and automobile parts, it seems like medical equipment is always a biggie for us.
Yes,
why
it is
that?
Well, there's sort of two wings to that, and part of it is there are some companies out in the Memphis area that are very big in orthopedics and artificial joints and that sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. And then in the Nashville area and then going out to Oak Ridge, you've got a lot of people doing medical instruments. And there's a growing pharmaceutical, although a lot of that's it's changing stuff that's come in, so it's re-exported. But those are the three medical sectors in the state.
Then you state in the first quarter of this year, Tennessee's foreign shipments went up 27.7% to $5.87 billion. Why the rise in the last quarter?
Well, that's because we are, at least in theory, coming out of the global recession. So we're just getting a bounce back.
Is it manifesting itself in this economic sector earlier than it is in others? Because people who look at the unemployment rate say, well, I'm not feeling this so-called recovery yet. Are importers and exporters feeling it? Or
this is true worldwide. It's not just the United States or the state of Tennessee. Exports have grown tremendously over the past year. I mean, they're bouncing back. It's not growth on top of what was there in 2007, but they're bouncing back very rapidly.
Mm-hmm. There's something you mentioned at the beginning, and it's about how you decide to categorize what state gets credit or what state gets credit for an export. The Census Bureau is
probably for an import, right?
Yeah, for imports at the state level. If it comes into the U.S. in California, does California get credit for it if it goes all the way into Tennessee and it gets sold in Tennessee? What's the logic? What's the reasoning there?
For
determining what's the rationale for determining which state gets credit for the import?
Well, what you try to do is find the ultimate user. And that's very hard to do for imports. For exports, it's easy because people have to fill out a declaration form so you can trace back where it came from, a shipper's mm-hmm. declaration form. It's much harder to do for imports. That's why it took the government so long to start putting out state-level import statistics. So they're trying to locate not the port, but who's actually consuming the thing in the United States.
And how do they trace it all the way to the end user?
It's estimates.
They just have to guess.
Yeah.
So they have to go to take it down right to the retail level and trace
it
to the actual store where it's
maybe the wholesaler, but probably not the actual. Okay. But I mean, a lot of it's just done by modeling, you know, where mm-hmm. things. But a huge number of imports are the user is not a consumer. It's not a family. Mm-hmm. It's a business, and that's easier to do.
Yeah. If something goes to a distribution center that serves an entire region, do you stop the tracking of it there instead of trying to figure out whether it goes from the distribution center in Arkansas to a store in Arkansas or to a store in Tennessee, for
example?
Well,
you've got to estimate that.
You've just got to, yeah. Based on what?
Well, yeah, I'd have to ask the federal government. I'd have to ask the Census Bureau. I don't know.
Does that help in any way to help economists try to figure out how we're doing? I mean, how does that figure into an economist's assessment of whether or not the overall economic picture is improving?
Well, that's a pretty hard question to answer. Do you mean for the U.S. or at the state level?
Well, take both of them individually.
I mean, at the state level, it's really difficult to get too worked up about imports because of all this estimation of who the final user is. At the state level, really, imports, it's kind of a sign of economic activity. When there's more economic activity, imports go up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's all that useful a sign because you could get the same information from other means, but mm-hmm. that's kind of what it's telling you. At the national level, well, rising imports are a sign of economic activity, too, because you're buying more and more stuff, but it's also, to an extent, a measurement of how competitive American firms are, because an import could be something you're buying that's made in the United States, but you're not. You're choosing to buy it in another country, so that's mm-hmm. that's giving you an indication of the competitiveness of American companies.
Do rises and falls in consumer confidence, the extent to which we're willing to go out and spend something because we think we're going to actually have more money coming in after we get through spending it or not, does that help in trying to assess things when it comes to imports and exports? How do you look at those in do you look at them in parallel universes, or do you look at them and see if there's any correlation?
Well, I think consumer confidence is trying to predict future economic activity. I'm not sure it gives you anything specific about exporting or importing.
But if a consumer is not willing to go buy things, whether regardless of whether they're imports or whether they're made domestically, then that could tell you something when it comes to specialty items or niche markets or something like that, couldn't it?
Well, it could probably give you, over the long run, a signal about the level of imports.
Mm-hmm.
But again, most imports are not going directly to a family; they're going to a business.
Mm-hmm.
So consumer confidence may not be the best way to read the trajectory of imports.
The canard that we hear these days is that we, the United States, don't make things anymore. Fair or unfair?
Well, we make a lot of things. And, of course, part of it's arbitrary when you decide what a thing is. Why is the only things that count something that you manufacture?
Something that you can hold in your hand.
If you make insurance, that's something, too.
Well, I think that the canard came out of the whole scandal over credit default swaps and derivatives and things like that. Sometimes people think if it's not a good as opposed to a service, if it's not something you can hold in your hand, then it's not something that is. If it's not tangible, it doesn't have any value, and that's not necessarily true. But how do you gauge the quality of goods versus services in an increasingly oriented, service-oriented economy? Do we need to get back to actually manufacturing tangible items in order to have more economic prosperity?
Well, I would say you have to produce things, but it doesn't have to be something that comes out of an assembly line. Take a doctor. A doctor is... that's producing something. Doctors are good jobs, even though they're not manufacturing something. So I don't think you want to get too hung up on the reason the United States has moved more from manufacturing to services, but there's still a huge number of manufacturers in the United States. It's not like manufacturing has just disappeared or something. But as you get richer and richer, your ability to just to spend all your money on manufacturers, it kind of hits a limit. There's only so many goods somebody can buy. And so at when people get richer, you start moving to tourism, to personal services, all this sort of thing. And that's why the American economy has moved that way. It's responding to a wealthier populace.
Are we, as consumers, more obsessed with things than perhaps we should be? Do we play by the old bumper sticker that the one who dies with the most toys wins?
Well, that's kind of outside my confidence. You need a professor of ethics for that. We probably are a materialistic culture, yeah.
Yeah. How would you describe our trade relationship with China right now?
Well, it's pretty tricky. We run a massive trade imbalance with China. It's I believe China has something like, what is it, $900 billion stored away from previous trade surpluses with the United States, and so that's become a tremendous political issue between the two countries.
What about in the state of Tennessee? What do we import from China?
Well, we import lots of things, lots of apparels and footwear come in from China. A lot of the state's got some big computer assembly plants here, and a lot of that stuff comes in from China. A lot of the parts for those things. That's probably the two biggest Chinese imports.
Does the fact that we are a landlocked state hurt us in terms of exporting goods?
Yeah, it probably does. It does in a statistical sense, in that sometimes coastal states with big ports basically get credited with more exports than inland states. It probably also affects the state a little bit in the sense that companies may not be as focused on exports because we're more insular. We really are far away from an ocean and really don't think about what's on the other side of it.
Even though we are centrally located within the southeast, in that we are bordered by so many different states on all sides. Memphis likes to call itself America's distribution center.
Yeah, most of that, of course, is North American distribution, right?
Yeah, right. There's a page in Global Commerce where you talk about sectors with the greatest growth and the sectors with the greatest decline, and there were two things I found really interesting.
Uh-oh.
Digital cameras and camcorders and USB flash memory devices are among the sectors with the greatest decline. Now, I thought those would be some of the hottest items on the market.
Well, remember, you're talking about specific companies, too, not just the product. And so if a company is shifting production around plants, or if you happen to be tied to a company that's not doing so well, you're going to get a big drop.
Okay, what?
I mean, a few years ago, Tennessee showed a big drop in laptops. Well, obviously, people were still buying laptops. It's just Dell was not doing as well as they'd done earlier. So sometimes it's the company that's the issue there.
I see. And soybeans, is there a big drop in soybeans because other countries can just grow their own?
No, part of that is crop rotation and things of that sort.
So it's seasonal?
So, yeah. Well, it's more than seasonal, it's annual. Mm-hmm. Right, you don't grow the same. I mean, farmers respond to prices.
Mm-hmm. So it's something to be expected at certain times?
Well, in this state, for example, cotton gyrates wildly, too. To some extent, it's the same issue
when
people decide to plant.
Yeah. In the sectors with the greatest growth, there's something called uncoated kraftliner. What is that?
I do not know every single product that Tennessee exports, but it's a paper-type product. It's an industrial packaging
paper
type thing.
Yeah. And almost all of the other things, the spark ignition piston engines, miscellaneous motors, and gas-powered trucks have to do with motor vehicles. We are heavily into motor vehicles.
Yes, Tennessee is very, it's got a lot of eggs in the same basket, and the basket's automobiles.
That's not a good thing to have all of your eggs in the same basket.
No, it isn't. I mean, I guess it's good to have a basket. So you don't want to say anything negative about the automotive industry.
Yeah.
But Tennessee's economy is very dependent on that one sector.
Mm-hmm. Do you do or engage in fearless forecasts like Dr. David Penn, the director of the Business and Economic Research Center?
Well, it depends on what you want me to forecast. give you a heads up. I'll see what I can do.
Would you forecast futures in a particular kind of commodity or kind of export good, for example? Or is that beyond the scope of what you do?
You mean how exports are going to trend in a specific product?
At some point in the future, either quarter in the next quarter or the next year, something like that.
No, we try to do some of that. Yeah, for larger, small exports, very difficult to do because they're so dependent on small things.
The Global Commerce is a publication of the Burke, isn't it?
Right.
It is.
Right.
How much of this is your own work, and how much of it is in conjunction with some of the economists at the Burke, or is this totally your baby?
And I write everything. So,
Do you have any graduate students help you crunch the numbers
or
anything?
Not right at the moment.
This is pretty much a one-man show.
It is right now. Yep.
It's kind of surprises me that you're the only person I know doing this. I don't know of any institutions, other institutions of higher learning in the state that are particularly focused publication-wise on the trade, on imports and exports. Why is that?
Well, it goes back. It's before I came to MTSU. The College of Business got a grant for developing its international education facilities. And part of that grant was to establish this newsletter.
This is about how long ago?
Oh, 1994, maybe, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing this since?
1995. That's issue one, yeah.
Oh, man. Well, and it comes out quarterly. Are you still going to, I just printed this out, but you do it totally online now.
We do now. I mean, that was one of the cost savings that... as you well know, MTSU has had to engage, and we used to mail it out. But right at the moment, we're just online.
Who uses Global Commerce? Who looks at it? What types of people?
Well, lots of people. Of course, journalists are around the state are one group of people I hear from a lot. Business people, especially smaller companies that are interested in exporting or trying to follow trends in exporting. And then the state, there's a sort of mini industry in business consulting and helping businesses export or deal with import matters, which includes the public sector, right? The state and federal agencies. And so I would say those are the three groups of people that I hear from anyway the most.
When Tennessee politicians take junkets abroad, economic and
development
junkets abroad, okay, when they take excursions abroad for purposes of economic development or trying to foster economic development, do we get out of them what we put into them?
Well, I don't really know how much we put into them anymore. There was a literature... I haven't looked at it recently, but there is some skepticism in the academic literature about the payoff of a lot of those. It actually isn't so much the trips per se. It's many states have not Tennessee so much, but they have offices around the world that try to attract businesses and that sort of a thing. And the academic literature suggests that maybe that stuff is not that successful in achieving its goals.
Is it because they don't talk to the right people, or is some of the discussion that they do could it just easily be undertaken via teleconferencing anymore?
I'm not really sure what I think the issue really is that most foreign companies, anybody that's big enough to think about investing in the U.S. is probably big enough that they can hire their own people or have their own contacts to see where they want to go.
And they can scope out Tennessee and make up their own mind about it.
They don't really have to rely on Ohio's export office.
Or director of community development or what? Yeah, or director of international development. Are states thinking internationally
Oh, yes, very much so.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Are they thinking internationally? I mean, Alabama attracted a Mercedes-Benz plant not so very long ago, just a few years ago.
Well, we got a Volkswagen even more recently.
Yeah. Are they thinking internationally because domestic businesses just don't, because small businesses have a very short shelf life, and the odds are against them when a small business person tries to roll the dice, tries to get the venture capital to start up and keep going and everything. Is that why they turn to international
companies?
Well,
I'm not sure it's one or the other. I think most states want businesses. I don't care where they come from.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tennessee is perfectly happy to have a business that moves here from Michigan or one that comes from Belgium.
Then what would make them attempt to entice a company from overseas as opposed to a domestic one? What are the criteria? What are the factors that would play into that decision-making process?
Well, it's going to be the same for both. I mean, people are going to be looking at sites. How good is the site? How good is the transportation to the site? How trained is the workforce? Mm-hmm. And then what's the tax structure? Mm-hmm. That's going to be the...
Yeah,
and they're going to, the state of Tennessee, I presume. I mean, I'm not an employee of the state. I guess I am an employee of the state of Tennessee, but I'm not in the Economic and Community Development Office. Mm-hmm. So I don't know specifically what they do, but they would offer the same kinds of things to an American firm or a foreign firm.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the MTSU Instructional Technology Grant that you got. You are a political science professor in addition to making a trade publication, and what you got the money for was to develop a web-based interactive learning video of congressional rules and legislative procedures. And what are you going to do with that?
Well, what I'm trying to do is, the House of Representatives in particular, when you pass legislation or when you debate legislation, is very rule-bound.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a bazillion rules, some very major. And you can teach these rules in the abstract. There's this rule, and then there's this rule, and then there's this rule.
And then watch your students fall asleep.
And, well, I can get them to do that on many, many different methods. But you can do it that way, or you can try to say, well, let's see these rules. Let's see somebody use these rules. Let's see how they use them. Let's see why they use them, because rules are power. Mm-hmm. And so how somebody uses a rule is just as important as what the rule is. And so what I'm doing is I'm taking a very big debate. It was the passage of the health care bill, Obamacare, back in when it was voted on in the House. And I have taken that whole debate, and basically we're going to create an interface where you can, if you are a student, go and click on a specific rule,
mm-hmm.
and it will invoke that part of the debate. And you can see that rule in the debate.
Like a YouTube video.
Sort of, except it's edited down, so and it can flow as well. So mm-hmm. if you want to see, well, how does this rule move to that rule,
yeah.
you can stream it so it will move directly from the one rule into the other rule.
And you don't have to watch the entire debate
no,
in order to
pick up... No, which is like 12 hours, I mean.
Yeah, pick up on this one rule being enforced.
Right.
Okay. How are you in the process of making it now? When
yes.
do you expect to be finished with
oh,
it?
Oh, Lord. My problem is I decided I wanted to do the health bill when I got started. And the health bill, the debate, is about four times as long as a typical major legislative debate.
Yes.
So the editing has just been been mammoth.
435 people, all of whom would want to get their licks in, right?
Yeah, well, most of whom couldn't, but that's a different story. That's a rule, too, right?
Yeah.
But I'm hoping to have everything up and running by the end of the summer.
And then you're going to try it out on your fall 2010 class?
Well, I don't have a fall. Well, not my. I'm going to use it in my Congress courses, which I don't have one in the fall, so... It'll be in the spring.
You'll just have to go to a website. They won't have to buy a video.
That's right.
Buy a DVD.
You just go to the course website,
like,
and there it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And most of your students, of course, are totally web savvy, so there shouldn't be any difficulty with that.
As far as I know.
As far as you know. What you said that this would be eventually be put into use not only in your classes, but be put up on the web for a broader
access. That's right.
Okay, how is that going to work?
Well, there's a an organization called Merlot, which is a sort of, I don't know, peer assessed set of teaching tools. And so the goal was to get that thing in Merlot. And so at that point, anybody that wanted it could get it, mm-hmm. use it.
I don't know what rule they invoked when Bob Dornan, who is now no longer a member of Congress, went off on a tangent one day, and he ignored several times the call from the chair that the time of the gentleman has expired, and then finally they just instructed the sergeant at arms to pull the plug on the microphone. So he couldn't be heard beyond the immediate area right in front of him. I'd like to commend whoever did that. You just got back from Israel. Tell me what you did there.
I was in a program that really is more like a seminar, I guess, that looked at counterterrorism specifically and Israel's experience with terrorism and counterterrorism more generally.
As a policy issue or in practical application?
Well, both. We looked at Israeli units that are engaged in counterterrorism activities, but then we also had lectures and discussions with mm-hmm. in the foreign minister's office and things of that sort about.
So you were there during the time of the flotilla
That's right.
incident?
That's right. Good and or bad timing.
what was it like being discussing that particular subject at a time when Netanyahu and the Turks were exchanging not so nice words?
Well, you get a very different perspective when you're there, of course. Israel was, on that particular issue, was pretty united there's a lot of debate about this, the choice of tactics, mm-hmm. but pretty united about the blockade itself. Mm-hmm. So you got a very different perspective on that there than you probably did here or mm-hmm. in Europe.
Was the consensus opinion that the Israelis who boarded the ship were the victims and not the aggressors?
That's right.
Pretty much.
That's right.
It was was that the buzz of the convention, as it were?
Oh, that was the. I mean, it was a big deal. You bet.
Yeah. What other sorts of things did you learn? I mean, to what extent can an academic like you learn things?
We can learn.
Well, no, I mean, with the necessity of Israel to keep certain state secrets for security purposes versus what you're able to pick up on.
Well, I mean, they certainly didn't reveal any great secrets.
Right.
We did see some things. We were asked not to identify units by name and mm-hmm. Things of that sort. So, I mean, there were they did reveal a lot. Mm-hmm. But much of what they showed us, we went and saw a number of different police units and military units that are engaged in counterterrorism. Mm-hmm. They were more interested, I think, in showing us how skillful they were, which they are, mm-hmm. than revealing tactics that no one could have imagined that people do or anything of that sort.
Right. No James Bond stuff,
no,
just
no,
a lot
no
of extreme competency.
No. But we did see, for example, I saw a group that specialize in camouflage, and you really have no idea how good somebody can be camouflaging themselves till you see something like this. So,
does the Mossad still live up to its worldwide reputation as one of the best?
Yes, although of course they've got a little egg on their face with this killing in Dubai that they're still suffering the fallout from.
But people look to Israel when it comes to defending oneself. I mean, people in this country, I think, look at them because of their unique situation and because they are surrounded by people who want to see the extermination of their country as a nation state, look to them for as the go-to people for how to protect yourself or how to protect one's own resources. Do you think that is fair, well-deserved?
They devote a tremendous amount of attention to it. There's no doubt about it, and they're very, very good at it. They are so good that at times you could argue that maybe they could be maybe a little less
zealous.
Zealous, there's a good word for you. But when you're there and you get the psychology of being surrounded by people who you think want to do you in, you can understand why they've got the set of policies that they do.
What do you intend to do with what you've learned?
That I am not an expert in terrorism. That's not my
specialty. Not your field.
So this is strictly to improve my courses, my ability to talk about these topics in my courses.
Okay. You and Karen Peterson ought to get together and share.
Well, right,
notes.
She is. Yeah, yeah.
To say nothing of Sean Foley in the history department, I'll bet he'd be fascinated because Karen visited the fence, as you know.
Yeah.
And
Karen, that was I was in the same program.
Yeah.
That's the same organization.
Same organization. Yeah. Dr. Stephen Livingston, king of trade, informational technology, and Israel. We covered the gamut
today. I think
today.
I'll give up some of those crowns.
Okay. Thanks for being with us today. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. And don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.